From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. As an issue involving strong interest on the part of business and the professions, education, government, and the churches, ethics at both individual and social levels is lately the focus of renewed attention in the United States. How is character communicated by parents and teachers? What are the limits of legitimate expectations regarding moral development as it extends beyond families and schools into the lives of adults as well as children? Soundings put those questions to Edmund Pinkoffs, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of moral philosophy at the University of Texas. At the center, Professor Pinkoffs is writing a book on the nature, development, and inculcation of moral character. Why all the interest in ethics?
Well, of course, Wayne, there are just lots of reasons. There are some obvious and some that are maybe not so obvious. Of course, there have been the sins and scandals of prominent politicians, as you know, abscam culprits and other people like that, and nearly every legislative body in the country, not just nationally. And there's been a rise, as you know, of crime, of white-collar crime and blue-collar crime, presumably no-collar crime as well. And there's been a lot of, more importantly, perhaps, there's been a lot of moral concern evident in the revolt of the 60s about the Vietnam issue, and that became a larger matter having to do with general public mores. And there were reactions to that revolt on the part of the moral majority, so that there's a great deal of moral turmoil, I think, in the country over general matters. And then in addition to all of that sort of moral ruckus, there is the occasion that arises when a lot of new technology and technical change comes into society and makes for problems that didn't exist before at all. This is particularly evident in the medical and biomedical field, where biomedicine has become a great source of moral issues. For example, there are problems of abortion, which have, of course, been with us, but there are esoteric ways of keeping lives going when the lives are beyond all hope or viability in as far as participating in the world anymore. There are problems of so-called in vitro fertilization, the genetic screening of the unborn by amniocentesis. You can find out in advance all kinds of things that genetic diseases that a so far unborn child may have. There are other sorts of sources of the burgeoning of ethics. There are a lot of judicial, legal debates that have to do with really essentially ethical problems. The judicial interpretation of the law, that is to say the question whether judges ought to make law by their decisions, or they should be what are called black letter people, that is people who go strictly by the Constitution, or whether they ought to take into account matters of equity and justice very strictly in determining what the law is, or whether they ought not worry about that. And then there's the general sense that the professions, like engineering or law, medicine, and so on, that business management, teaching, that these are positions of trust, and that the trust is sometimes being violated. And it isn't necessarily the case that these are evil people violating trust, but that they ought to know what the guidelines are. And there's a great deal of burgeoning interest in making clear what those guidelines are, and more remotely but importantly, determining the principles on which those guidelines ought to be made clear. But I am inclined to think that the philosophers, who are the academicians who have been primarily concerned with ethics, have rested much too heavily and much too unreflectively on certain standard theories, with the assumption that those theories will necessarily be relevant to the sorts of problems that people are really faced with.
What kind of theories, for example?
Well, there are, in fact, three sorts of theories that are I suppose, could be called standard today. One is consequentialism. I hate to engage in neologisms here, but consequentialism is a general theory to the effect that it's the consequences that count. That is, the best known form of consequentialism is utilitarianism.
And this is to say that we don't necessarily ignore, but we put the emphasis not on intentions.
That's right.
But on the results, on the effects.
We put the emphasis not on intentions, not on virtue, not on vice, not on the character of the individual, not on even on duties or obligations, except so far as those have good, following those duties or obligations would have good consequences for everyone concerned.
This would be, for instance, the kind of thing that some individuals might argue for in terms of policy about convicts, about prisoners. What kind of results are you getting rather than how are you going about it?
Exactly. From the, well, even from the time of the ancients, that sort of position is one position that has been taken. It was especially prevalent in the 17th and 18th centuries, and there's a big history of the debate. And by and large, the debate turns on consequentialist terms. And the most famous consequentialist was the utilitarian, probably the utilitarian Jeremy Bentham, whose work led to the great reforms of the English criminal law. The second sort of theory is what I would call a formal theory, that has no substantive content, but is a theory that rests primarily just on consistency. In other words, for if you're at all familiar with the with Kant's moral philosophy, it rests on what Kant called the first formulation of the categorical imperative.
And goodness,
well,
what
let me run that through.
What does all that mean?
Well, what Kant said, and I'll not use Kant's language, which is abstruse, is that by and large what you should ask yourself when you're asking yourself whether something is right or wrong is whether you could will that anyone who finds himself in the same position you are should do what you propose to do. But a purely formal theory is a theory of consistent universal legislation that the individual lays down for himself, or he thinks of himself as a universal legislator.
Edmund, pardon me for being naive, but how in the world could a philosopher even hope for something like that, given the incredibly checkered moral history of the human race?
Well, of course, Kant, you know, when you're steering a ship, it's nice sometimes to have a star to steer by.
I see.
And it isn't your intention to get to the star.
What you're looking at then, Edmund, is not the goal so much as the process of reaching the goal.
Well, that's a nice insight, I think, Wayne. Yes, I mean, on that sort of theory, what you are interested in is how you think about a particular moral issue that may face you. Now, of course, the difficulty with a theory of that kind is that everything turns on what the individual does will. That is, if a consistently malevolent person can will things that you and I might not approve, but he would nevertheless be willing consistently and universally. Mm-hmm. The third and position, and one that has received very well worked out treatment in our own time through the work of John Rawls in A Theory of Justice, is contract theory. There are lots of predecessors of contract theory. Hobbes is one, Rousseau is another, and so on. And roughly, very roughly, what contract theory amounts to is that the rights and the wrongs are the consequences of prior actual or hypothetical agreements that people have reached, and you and I, in determining whether we may jointly go out and engage in some joint venture together, whether a moral problem arises, we've got to ask ourselves about whether we, in engaging in that sort of practice, would be violating any of the agreements that persons in the formation of society would have taken for granted.
Edmund, how generally aware would you say people are of these three philosophical options?
I think they are in their own way. I think that the theories themselves derive some of their force from the fact that they don't just come out of the sky. Mm-hmm. They come out of our ongoing culture.
People actually live this way.
People live this way. Yeah. They think about... some people are, I think, sort of naturally or culturally inclined to think more in terms of what the outcomes are, what the consequences will be. Some people are more naturally inclined to think in terms of what you might think of as the golden rule, which, by the way, is a form of formal theory.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it doesn't tell you anything substantive. It just tells you how to think. And I think that contract theory is something that comes out of common culture, too. That is, people think, well, look, would I, in doing what I propose to do, be violating a sort of common understanding that people live by that constitutes an agreement, a sort of prior agreement to the way of life that we all share?
Mm-hmm.
I think people naturally think in these terms.
Why is it that we cannot simply say that ethics is a matter of rules?
Mm-hmm. Well, it has to do with the reductiveness of a notion like that, I guess, primarily. That is, the language that we have is a very rich vehicle. It contains all sorts of terms that we intuitively recognize as moral. It's full of terms like honesty, that is an honest thing or dishonest thing to do, that would be untruthful, or that would be negligent, it would be a vengeful thing to do, it would be helpful to do this for another person, but if you did that other thing, it would be selfish, and so on. We have a very varied sort of language. And I am suspicious of the attempt to throw all of the things that we can say to each other in assessing not only proposed acts and policies and so on, but each other, that is, as persons with moral qualities, under rules and principles. It seems to me that that's an unnecessarily rigid way of thinking about the subject, and one that's likely to overlook all of the many ways of assessment we do in fact have. But I think that the issue there really is, the point is, that unfortunately for simplifiers and reductivists, moral issues tend to be rather complex issues when you look at the ways, the many different ways in which we can assess what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad, not only with respect to acts, as I said, but with respect to persons.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that very often the terms like honest or just that apply to acts also apply to persons, and it's interesting that they can be self-reflexive terms, so that when I raise the question whether I ought to do something, and I worry whether it's dishonest, I'm not just worrying about the description of the act, I'm worrying about myself, whether I'm dishonest in proposing to do that act. And the same has to do with justice and courage. And
doesn't this come down to situation ethics? Mm-hmm. Everything deserves an answer of its own, and therefore there is no consistency?
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that what you have to do is make some distinctions at that point. You have to talk about what's necessary in a common moral code, which you might call a minimal code that people have to abide by. And there, to some extent, rules are desirable.
Mm-hmm.
That is a minimal morality that mm-hmm. we're talking about. That is to say, it tells us what is permissible, but it doesn't necessarily tell us what we ought to do.
I see.
And it seems to me that the distinction ought to be made between a minimal and a non-minimal morality.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about the nature, development, and inculcation of moral character as a quality appropriate to a democratic polity such as America's. The speaker is Edmund Pinkoffs, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of moral philosophy at the University of Texas. Why is it that there's so much emphasis on these very extreme issues in ethics, and yeah. and the corollary to that being that's where we find all the answers? Mm-hmm. That isn't true, is it?
No, it isn't true, and in fact, I have intense reservations about some moral educational programs that do focus on the very difficult, complex, extreme problems.
Rather than the day-to-day behavior.
Rather than the day-to-day behavior.
Yeah.
It does seem to me that moral education has to be concerned inevitably with the formation of character, and that the formation of character is really the first job of moral education, and that you don't do that by presenting children with extreme and difficult choices. They have to be made aware, of course, that they do have to think about mm-hmm. the difficulties that may arise, but they have to be first put in a position to think. They have to be people who have the right sorts of sentiments, and if they don't have those sentiments, if, for example, they come up callous or indifferent or selfish, then they're or with no sense for what's cruel or for what's unjust, then they're not ready to talk about those big issues. And so that I would think that the primary business is to make people just the sort of people who do come through in the right way, have the right attitudes.
Mm-hmm. What's going on in the schools with regard to what's called values education, moral education?
Well, you have to divide that question into two. What's going on explicitly in terms of programs mm-hmm. for value education, and what's going on anyway aside from the programs? And the answer to the second is obviously a lot, because it's inevitable that there will be some kind of moral learning that's going to take place in the schools, and the schools had better think about it, because if they don't, why, the moral learning that goes on will be rather haphazard, and in fact will turn perhaps too heavily on peer learning. That is to say, children inevitably learn a great deal of their morality from each other.
You make me think of Lord of the Flies.
Yes, right. I think that would be apropos. So that you don't want a school that operates in the way that island did, with the teachers sitting off on benches, gazing off into the distance.
Well, what deliberately is being taught in the schools?
Well, there are several different programs. I'll just mention the two most popular ones. One is the moral developmental work that turns around the work of Piaget and Kohlberg. Kohlberg, who is the more recent of those psychologists, holds that there are six levels of moral development, and that the business of moral education should be to raise or help to raise children from one level to another level. There are levels through which inevitably in the early stages they will go, or there's an order through which they will go. It is not inevitable that they will achieve higher levels. The second sort of program is associated with the psychologist Simon, and it is called values clarification. Now, values clarification consists in a method whereby children are essentially asked, treated in a certain way, put through certain programs that enable them or encourage them to clarify the values that they themselves have. This has been worked out in great detail with all sorts of handbooks and whatnot, and there are workshops all over the place, both for values clarification and for the moral developmental approach associated with Kohlberg. That is, the issue, I think, is not merely clarifying one's values, but trying to work toward the right values and getting a critical reading on what values there are that one perhaps ought to have. The tendency, I think, of a values clarification approach is, unfortunately, to reinforce a relativism that the child already comes to school with. That is to say, the relativism that tells him that your ideas on right and wrong are your ideas and my ideas are my ideas, and de gustibus non disputandum est, although I doubt if he'd use those words. And so that he's just ready to gobble that kind of thing up, because there's nothing more precious to him than the values he has and the business of clarifying them.
And this simply ratifies them. It doesn't necessarily clarify them.
Well, it ratifies them. It ideally make him think about them, because he is led to realize that whatever values he has, he's got to live with, and he's got to stand behind, and so forth. So I have no objection to that part of the thing at all. But I do think that the critical evaluation of values tends to be lost. This is welcome to teachers who want to take no moral position, by the way, because they themselves have to interject nothing. They only have to make the child think about the values that the child has.
In other words, this is non-judgmental.
It is non-judgmental.
And you see that as a weakness?
I see it as a weakness, yes. I think that we've got to get beyond those days. I think that the social sciences are getting well beyond them, and that it's a dead social science that has its weight on the educational profession. There's an even worse sort of accusation that can be raised against the line of stuff that I'm presenting here, and mm-hmm. that is that it just amounts to what Kohlberg calls the bag of virtues approach. What you do is lump together all these virtues and you sort of unload them on the unhappy head of the poor child who's trapped in school and can't get away.
Where do we look for ethics and morality? Where do we look for answers to questions about ethics and morality? The home, the church, the schools?
Well, the answer is of course that we have to look to all of those places, but then we have to ask ourselves the practical question, where we can do the most, where we have the most leverage, and what sort of leverage we want, that is, what sort of character we want in a citizen who is a citizen of a republic. There are large complex questions about a pluralistic democratic society and what can defensibly be done in the schools in the line of moral education. To speak rather abstractly, you can't inflict on children your particular version of a morality that may be defensibly at odds with the morality of his family, of the background out of which he comes, and so forth. So that one of the issues here is what, in the name of the common good and the common life within a democracy, where people have a right to the greatest extent possible to be free and to lead their own lives, can the schools defensively do in the line of a character education? If the focus is kept where I think it should be kept, on character, and if we're talking about the sort of moral character that people have, that is not the sort of area where there should be any kind of conflict between church and state, or between family morality and the morality of everyone. Who is opposed to honesty? Who is opposed to sincerity? Who is opposed to truthfulness, loyalty, consistency, reliability, and so on? These are non-debatable truisms, as far as I can see. Who's opposed to non-cruelty? Again, I don't want to put this in sociological terms. I take it
you want to bring it back to the individual.
I want to bring it back to the individual. Let me put it this way. Let me turn it around. I think that's a good suggestion, to the individual. You're a child in school. You're not yet acquainted with the world. You have a teacher. Let's say one teacher for simplicity. This teacher realizes, or ought to realize, that his or her sole business is not with pumping a lot of information into you, but preparing you for the world into which you are going to move. That means that that teacher has to be conscious that you're developing certain traits, and that if you develop some traits, you're going to be the kind of person who not only is not preferred by other people generally, but ought not be preferred by other people generally. If you develop the trait of dishonesty, then it's easily predictable that you won't be preferred and that you shouldn't be. And it's easily arguable that you shouldn't be preferred. Now, as a teacher, you have an obligation to that child. The teacher has an obligation to the child. The teacher has to do something about, has to be aware of, that child's need to become the right sort of person. And that's a term that I tend to think about a lot, the right sort. It seems to me that that's the business of teachers, is to help prepare the right sort. There's a wonderful book by Tom Wolfe, you probably know, called The Right Stuff, and it's about the astronauts, and it's about what it means to have the kind of characteristics that can carry a person through the very rigorous sort of life that those people have had to go through and the rigorous competition that they've moved through. No one is going to say that everyone has to have the right stuff in that sense.
Yeah.
But people do have to be aware, that is, teachers have to be aware, and children eventually have to be self-aware of the need for honesty, of the need for trustworthiness, of the need not to be cruel, and so forth. It can be a discovery for a child that the child is being cruel. That is, picking the wings off of flies and tying cans to dog tails may be just the beginning of a moral learning process. When the teacher points out that there's something wrong with that.
What would you say to people who object to that and say, wait a minute, my kid has rights. My kid can do whatever my kid wants to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that has to be taken head on. And if the person is objecting to insistence on honesty, insistence on truthfulness, insistence on loyalty, insistence on reliability, dependability, insistence on not being cruel, and not being unduly selfish, then I think that the person who argues that it's okay for his kid to be selfish and so on, has to be ignored. I don't think, in fact, anybody will argue that.
Mm-hmm.
If that person not only doesn't value honesty, but doesn't value justice, doesn't value dependability, doesn't value non-fanaticism, doesn't value whatever, you see. I mean, we've got to find a place. And if we find a place, if, for example, he values justice, perhaps we can move from justice to selfishness. And perhaps then we can move farther. But there has to be common ground. This is not a sociological matter. This is not a matter of finding out what everyone approves, but of trying to build rational dialogue between people on central issues. And I think that we don't determine what ought to be encouraged in the way of moral development in the schools according to any kind of sociological survey.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. My guest was Edmund Pinkoffs, a scholar at the center and a professor of philosophy at the University of Texas. Send us your comments. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the John M. Olid Foundation, and is distributed by the Public Radio Cooperative.